Morning will be from Sarah Mazza, professor at Northwestern of French cultural history from the 18th through the 20th century is her field. Her latest book, Violette Nozière, A Story of Murder in 1930s Paris, and a forthcoming book she has entitled Thinking About History. It's coming out of University of Chicago Press.
Well, as you can imagine, I had a lot of fun reading these papers by noted cultural historians on crisscrossing themes. The great thing about these kinds of people who write on these themes is that they love their material and it shows. I mean, they're just on fire. I'll address the papers separately because they raise somewhat different issues, but you know, there are obvious connections. Robin's and Dominique's papers are methodologically similar. Vinnie's and Robin's overlap because Vincenzo Perugia considered himself something of an avenger of the Italian nation. I think it's a great coincidence that The Long Birth of Fantomas in his 32-volume series coincides pretty much exactly with the years of the missing Mona Lisa, 1911 to 1913. I think for me this is strong circumstantial evidence that it was Fantomas who actually stole the And I've got another link between Vinnie's and Dominique's that I'll mention later. And I'll try and be brief because I want to leave you guys some time for questions. Vinnie Dada's paper historicizes famous Fait divers, the theft of the Mona Lisa in 1911. And she connects it to a range of anxieties, animosities, and technological developments. And the most conspicuous anxiety, well, maybe not the most conspicuous, the one that you stress right off the bat is fear of crime during the first decade of the 20th century, what Robert Nye identifies as la grande peur de la bourgeoisie, the apex of which probably is the 1905 frenzy over the murderer and pedophile Sordillon that derailed the first attempt in France to abolish the death penalty. So this is the one aspect of your paper that it's not so much that I disagreed, but I would like to push you on because the fear of crime is such an enduring theme that it's very hard to historicize precisely. In the long 19th century mode where it becomes proxy for the anxieties around urban modernity, the fear of modernity, the city, fear of strangers, and so on, you find it upstream with the material in Louis Chevalier, and then you find it right through the Third Republic, fanned by all these sensational faits divers press. So, you know, from Troppmann in 1869 to Weidmann in 1939, the last guy executed in public. Anywhere you slice, that's probably the wrong word, you find crime phobia. So that's the part of the paper that I'm skeptical about, not so much because it's wrong, but because the explanatory power of that is, the explanatory range is so broad that I don't think it's as helpful as it could be. There's crime and crime, and I'm guessing that being shocked by the theft of a masterpiece or titillated by a crime of passion like Henri F. Caillou's, are not the same as being afraid of being stabbed by an Apache gang in your neighborhood. So the fear of crime and also the other kind of major elements that cover a long period, like gender panic and depopulation, those are very blunt instruments, I think, for the Third Republic or for this long 19th century. But actually, I was intrigued to hear that you and Dominique are writing an article together because, in fact, what you give us is the dark side of, you know, dark story of the Belle Époque. And I wonder how this fits with Dominique's investigation. I haven't yet read the very new book about the Belle Époque and, you know, what you both have to say together or in dialogue about whether or not this is a Belle Époque and so on. So that was where I had the reservations. The other themes in the paper strike me as much more unexpected and rich, one being the mass reproduction of the Mona Lisa in the daily press and its emergence decisively as the national icon it's exhaustingly become. I mean, I guess it's a good painting, but who knows anymore? It's sort of like the Kardashians. It's famous for being famous. And again, this is where all that really begins. I'm intrigued by your proposition that Mona Lisa became a stand-in for Marianne, and I wondered whether that's your interpretation or whether the point was ever made by contemporaries or just suggested. I wondered also, in the context of all those fascinating comments about Americans, whether the Statue of Liberty ever came up, because, you know, if they were stealing the Mona Lisa when we had just given them the Statue of Liberty, that would be a very interesting point to make. And the material about anti-Semitism and anti-Americanism in this period is really intriguing to me, because we tend to think of the heyday of anti-Semitism around Dreyfus, and then that gets, you know, beaten back by the Dreyfus case. So the successful resolution at the very end around 1900, and then we know that there's a surge of this stuff in the 1930s, and I had always thought that the Jews and Americans theme was that was a very 30s theme. So finding those themes present in the early decade, that was the first decade of the century, is really surprising. We'd have to go back to what Philippe Roger has to say about it, and I don't know how he deals with that period. And I think that the nationalist framework is really convincing, the way in which this became a theme for the expression of nationalism. And finally, what I liked most about the paper was the theme of cultural appropriation, which clearly is there in the appropriation of the reappropriation of the painting by Perugia. But even more so, this rich tapestry of appropriation of the painting by popular culture, not just in the popular press, but in actual carnivals. I mean, there were carnival floats during this time of the Mona Lisa, and lots of satirical themes and lots of elite irritation at the mass cultural desecration of a major artwork. So, and paper offers a wealth of different reactions to the theft, and while it's framed by anxiety and outrage, there's also a lot of humor and satire. So I'm wondering who is feeling what exactly. So my reaction to the paper, was that this event is really a terrific window into the high-low culture dynamic, and that I think that is really what I'd like to hear more about, you know, what it means in terms of how people respond to high art and the anxieties that people have about high culture. So just shifting to Robin Walz. Robin introduces us to the figure of the Dark Avenger. It's a theme I've never thought about much, and I'm probably not qualified, so I don't have that much to say. I only read Monte Cristo as a kid in a bowlerized version, although I've seen, I read an abridgment, and I've seen, of course, I love this kind of thing, so I've seen all the movies, I think. And it's interesting that in the movies, I didn't realize that the backstory was so short in the Dumas, because all the movies are like really foreground the backstory, which is interesting in terms of what you say about how the backstory was added as a way of moralizing the story. It's an interesting perspective on the Avenger theme. I was reminded that I was on a plane recently. Planes are always a great excuse for watching certain kinds of movies. I was watching the Liam Neeson starring movie Taken, where the American father travels to Paris to rescue his kidnapped daughter. And this gives them an excuse to kill a lot of guys in satisfyingly brutal ways. And I was thinking, reading Robin's paper, that in Hollywood movies, violence or threats of violence against the hero's family, the wife and the children, always give you a moral license to kill. You know, it's as good as the James Bond technical license to kill. This would all be good fun if in America the specter of lynching weren't there in the background. You know, Avengers come in white cloaks as well. So in Robin's paper, we're introduced to some of the 19th century avatars of the genre. Robin's digging into collector's bulletins rewarded with a useful typology of early protagonists of the crime thriller, the grand criminel, the grand justicier, and the grand policier. I love that trilogy. Here he introduces us to the grand justicier by way of an illuminating contrast between contrast between the social justicier, Rodolphe or Jean Valjean, and the personal one such as Dantès. And by contrasting Dumas' novel with the story on which it was based, which was allegedly real but probably also a fiction, Robin shows the loss of moral reprobation of the avenger, who in Dumas becomes a demoralized purveyor of thrills. I was really fascinated by the scene in the earlier story, the counter-avenger, and the death scene that is so much in the mode of classic early 19th century melodrama. It's written for the stage, and it has that kind of Peter Brooks way of clearly naming the moral stakes. And, you know, that's what you don't have in the later 19th century, and that's what's really fascinating. So I didn't really have any good questions. I just had a meta question. The meta questions is just about the typologies, because you have both the typologies of the three categories, but you also have the typology of traits, which I thought was interesting also. And I'm just interested in the next stage of things as you're writing, how you're thinking of deploying these typologies when you put it all back together. I mean, you analyze it, you pick it apart, and then, you know, you've got to put it back together. And I was wondering how that works, but probably that's the question you've been asking yourself. So Dominique Khalifa, finally. Oh, okay. I'm doing good. Introduces us to the surprisingly long arm of Fantômas, a much more proliferating genealogy than I had ever imagined, stretching through and beyond the 20th century and metastasizing from one genre to the next, jumping from the start from page to screen and eventually all media. Though actually I got curious and I looked up, but I didn't find any video games. Are there? Okay, that's surprising. You'd think video games would get good Fantômas support. Dominique suggests an explanation of Fantômas' durability by highlighting the ways in which the structure of the Fantômas story likens it to both epic and myth, since the main characters are all related and mean changes on various forms of family romance, with an evil father, lost and found children, fratricidal brothers, and so on. And he suggests that this is kind of the epic of the 20th century. So I have a couple of questions. One is out of curiosity, and I want to drag you in the opposite direction of your paper, which is to ask about the myth of Fantômas in its synchronic rather than its diachronic dimension. I'm curious about what the resonances of this character are in the early 20th century, where this image of the dangerous, urban, black-clad ghost criminal with amazing powers, where it comes from, and how it resonates with other contemporary fictions. And I ask this because I'm aware, you know, not being anything of a specialist in this area, the two other fictions I know of with long afterlives are The Phantom of the Opera, Gaston Leroux's 1909 story, and a bit later, which of course has, you know, proliferated in a similar way, and a bit later in 1927, Belle Fagot, The Phantom of the Louvre. These phantoms have an affinity for high culture places, don't they? Which is Belle Fagot, if you don't know, he's a black-clad phantom who hangs out in the Louvre and murders people, and he's associated with, what is it, Egyptian antiquities, and so you're right. So there was a lot of ghost criminals running around Paris in the early 20th century. Where does the original Fantômas fit into that set of contemporary intertexts? And then I just want to bring up the sort of very, very broad claims that you make for Fantômas as the epic of the 20th century, and the way in which it speaks to the shock of modernity, the uncanny forces of the modern city, science, war, revolution, massacres, and so on. So the claims there are very, very big, and you know, I just wanted to hear more about how they're related to the specifics of the stories. I think it's probably because you were just, you know, writing this for, you know, as a survey, but I'm willing to believe you, but I wondered if I want to paraphrase Lena Dunham here. I want to say it's maybe not the epic of the 20th century, it's an epic of the 20th century. but, you know, you have also this dialectic between high and low culture that resonates with Vinnie's paper and, of course, with Robin's classic work, Pulp Surrealism. So this panel is quite a treat in that it addresses a coherent topic, crime in the social imaginary, of the long 19th century in France, but it does so through three very distinct methodologies, microhistory, typology, and genealogy. And so I hope that the panelists and the audience can speak to the interface of these methods. Thank you.
Questions? Yeah.
I'm Joelle Nylander.
I just was thinking about that notion of Mona Lisa being sullied, and it really made me think of Duchamp, right? And Elle a chaud au cul.
Yes.
Yep. And that idea of her, and that, again, that question of high art, low art, or whatever that is, and thinking about that idea of her moving from that high range into that popular range and what that does to her reputation in that way. One other thing I also wanted to say to Fantomas and also to Robin, to both of you. I with a 4.5-year-old, we watch a lot of children's films, and we've been watching Minions, and of course... It's a French, the whole thing is French. All the animators are French. And I've just been thinking of Gru and the Minions and the way they fit into this sort of criminal hero, right? And into this trope of sort of that fantasy of that. And the Minions, of course, following each wonderful criminal, right? They look for the big boss and they follow to try to help that big boss, the Yeti, the dinosaur, whatever. And they go through the ages doing that and ending up finally, after Scarlet Overkill, they end up with Gru. And I was just thinking about how that fits in with this theme. It just struck me. So that's more of a comment, but I do think it's interesting how that continues even today.
Liana Vardy, SUNY Buffalo. I was interested in the Mona Lisa as national symbol, in part because a student of mine for a class presented the Woman in Gold, and in the Woman in Gold there's a lot of Austrian claim that it had become the symbol of Austria, and how could it possibly move, etc. And so I was very interested in how the Mona Lisa became the symbol of France. What was the symbol then before, if any? And also, in terms of Marianne, is this a counter symbol? I think Sarah might have raised this. How do you think about the representation of the nation through these iconic paintings or, you know, images?
It's a great question, and Sarah asked me about it as well. And you asked whether there was a reference to Marianne. I found one reference to Marianne in the articles I read. Not specifically the Mona Lisa is Marianne, and I just the more I thought about it, and the more I read those articles about the painting, it seemed to me that this there was a movement of those two figures together, in part because this painting, which of course was well known, then became disseminated everywhere in the same way that you have statues and reproductions of Marianne. I probably need to do some more homework to make the links, but I already find them there. Whether there is a symbol beforehand, whether there's a painting that represents France beforehand, it's not clear to me. I always think of the Delacroix painting, and maybe there's some kind of link that I can make between the Marianne in that painting and the Mona Lisa as Marianne.
Sarah Fishman, but a comment again about of present day, because I normally don't go to see like scary movies, but I did go see Get Out, and there you've got your Avenger again, which, you know, and because of the way that it was structured, I actually enjoyed watching him avenge himself at the end. So I don't know, again, it's just sort of these persistent themes in the way that they can be used.
And can I follow up on what Sarah's saying here, because I think it's going to pull together, I think, a few comments that you had, Sarah, which is like how much you enjoyed the Avenger thing at the end, because La Grande Peur, it's also, you know, a big theme in Richard Abel's The Cine Comes to Town, and this notion of you know, experiencing great fear as entertainment, and the idea that each new mass media form that's coming out is going to be like recycling that in and re-energizing that. And it's going to be re-energizing that. And this is why Louis Chevalier is stuck in the early and mid-19th century and can move no further forward, because it's part of this whole imaginaire concept, which is because it takes into account modernity and these transformations. And in fact, the ability for the spectacle, if you will, to be reinvigorated over and over and over again, and at the same time become further and further and further, let's see, what's the relationship to social reality? Becomes pretty tenuous. Although, as Get Out showed, it can have amazing power, right? But I just wanted to kind of point that out, that it's, you know, nobody experiences the apache on the street in your neighborhood, which is just a very limited time of period of time. But it becomes this thing that can be read about, that can be seen in movies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I got to contribute my Rock and Bull article in a collection called The Re-Enchantment of the World. And it's kind of anti-Weberian in tone, which is to say, you know, modernity does not only disenchant the world, it also re-enchants the world in a variety of ways. And anyway, I just wanted to follow up on all that, and I think it pulls together some of the things you were talking about.
Right. So what Vinnie's talking about is prime and the imaginary.
Yes.
Right.
That's
exactly.
Right. That's what I wanted to answer.
That's what I missed.
Yes. Yeah. And that's my fault for not making it clear then.
Okay.
Are there any other comments you want to make?
Yeah, of course. pas de vidéo, pas de video games. J'en ai pas vu. En revanche, des robots japonais, en nombre important, qui incarnent, qui représentent la figure de Fantômage. Bon, mais on peut chercher des vidéos. Synchronie, diachronie. Oui. Fantômage incarne dans la synchronie toutes les angoisses et les menaces de belle époque, les apaches. Mais, et ça c'est assez facile, si tu veux, à percevoir. Après, ce qui m'a intéressé, c'est de comprendre pourquoi cette capacité synchronique qu'il avait, et que n'a pas Belphégor ou le fantôme de l'opéra, pourquoi cette capacité synchronique a pu aussi fonctionner de façon hallucinante dans des contextes différents et jusqu'à nos jours. Et donc, ça, c'est peut-être ce que je n'ai pas expliqué. Ce que Fantômas arrive à articuler, c'est à la fois toute l'angoisse politique 1911-1913, il est l'exact contemporain de Bonneau et des attentats anarchistes, même s'il n'a rien à voir avec ça, mais il arrive à incarner tout cela. La modernité technique, au sens, et la modernité scientifique et technique, le meurtre de masse, et la culture. Et ça, cette convergence-là, elle est, à mon sens, inédite et elle est unique dans les figures de la culture populaire du début du XXe siècle.
Donc c'est ça qui résonne.
Thank you, panelists, and thank you.